Today's topic is kind of a lurid one. And this is Tamar, Absalom, Amnon. This is like where it's really all of those like violent things you can think of. There's murder, there's rape, it's just awful. And so what do we do with this? So I'm going to start with a what would you say? Because it's like, how do you apply this text? That's the question you ask. Like if I was going to preach to an adult audience, if I had kids, I wouldn't preach on it at all. Okay. Because there's no way to like sugarcoat this one. But if I was going to like say, if I was going to preach on this or give like the moral of the story, what are you going to do? So I was exploring. I had two commentaries. I have a Concordia commentary and then the Brazos commentary. And a Robert Barron is actually, he's a Roman Catholic bishop, actually. But he's very, very broad. This is a mere Christian take on things. So I got Robert Barron, I got our commentary, and even theirs. I'm like, there's not a lot of application here. You know, they kind of talk about what's in the text and what's happening and what's the social context, but then they just kind of move on because there's not a whole lot. But there's a couple of comments that both make, and our Lutheran Study Bible actually makes some comments. And so one of the things that was mentioned in a couple of the commentaries was that private and public sin issue. So one of the things that takes place in these with this, what would you say is we live in a culture where everybody's about very much private and individualized rights, and the Bible doesn't think that way. And so how this will be accused to Christians, and this is going to be kind of one of my applications. I'm just introducing you to this. And again, this is what would you say, Breakpoint, Colson Center. Why should we care what consenting adults do in private? That's how, and so in other words, and it starts with that, but really it has even greater implications because the idea is even though, yes, certain things shouldn't be on display, a lot of the stuff that happens behind closed doors affects everyone, families, cultures, civilizations, and societies. And that's what's going to happen with David and Absalom and Tamar and Amnon in this really kind of difficult text. So let's look at this really quickly. This is just a little 4 minute intro for it to kind of get the conversation going. And then we'll look at 2 Samuel 13 and 14 with this as kind of like our context. Here we go.
You're in a conversation and someone says, "What consenting adults do in private is none of our business. It's between them and it doesn't affect anyone else." What would you say? The phrase, "What happens in Vegas stays in Vegas," was a popular tourist campaign that encouraged people to think that they could experience a kind of anonymity and freedom there that they couldn't achieve anywhere else. Of course, it wasn't true. What we do anywhere, even Vegas, has real consequences. In the same way, people often claim that sex is an entirely private act between consenting adults behind closed doors, and therefore no one should criticize or regulate sexual behavior. Of course, sex, like going to the bathroom or taking a shower, is not meant to be a public act. However, though sex is meant to be experienced privately, that doesn't mean there are no public consequences for the sexual behavior we allow as a society. There are. So the next time someone says that sex is merely a private act, here are three things to remember. Number one, sexual activity affects public health. According to the Center for Disease Control, roughly 20 million new sexually transmitted infections occur every year in America. Half of these infections are among young people ages 15 to 24. The estimated healthcare costs for these infections are $16 billion per year. This is an expense everyone pays for, sexually active or not. And there is also a cost of human life. In 2017, there were 94 infant deaths related to syphilis. Sadly, these newborns lost their lives because of what their parents did behind closed doors, which leads to our second point. Number two, sexual activity is procreative. Sex is the natural means by which humans procreate. Since sex has the potential of creating new life, a result that affects the entire community, its consequences are not limited to within the walls of the bedroom. Sex quite literally affects entire societies. Think about it. I'm here talking and you're here watching because of what our parents did in private. Everything we say and do, every moment of our lives is a testimony to the fact that what our parents did that day did not just affect them. This point is so obvious, we often forget it. We're constantly told that we can do whatever we want with our own bodies. The music we listen to and the movies we watch tell us that sex is just a fun act that people do behind closed doors. but each one of us is affected by this so-called private act. Number three, our sexual experiences affect our mental health and deeply shape our character. Sex is a big deal, and it affects us deeply. Our sexual experiences shape the development of our character and influence our psychological health. Given that sex is such a powerful bonding experience, there is good reason to believe that casual sex contributes to feelings of loneliness and depression. People are vulnerable in sex, and as a result, it's impossible to separate our private experience of sex with the effect we have on our community through our character and our health. Sex may be practiced in private, but for at least these three reasons, it is the concern of the whole community. What happens in Vegas doesn't stay in Vegas, and what happens in the bedroom doesn't stay in the bedroom. So the next time you're in a conversation and someone says that sex is just a private act, remember these three things. Number one, sexual activity affects public health. Number two, sexual activity is procreative. Number three, our sexual experiences affect our mental health and deeply shape our character. For What Would You Say? I'm Brooke McIntyre.
Okay, so that's a good intro to this, because what David and Bathsheba did in private in 2 Samuel 12 has huge consequences, okay? Because this is one of those adultery. And of course, David uses, you know, and consent can be coerced, and we can debate all that stuff. That's actually not the point. The point is that this avenue of things, whether it's consent or whether it's violence, in the case of Absalom here and Amnon, and the half brothers and half sisters here, it has real world consequences. It doesn't just stay there. It has real world brokenness that we see in the family, and this is one of those passages. And so we see David's failure starting to reap fruit in these passages. And so I'm going to display these for you, and then I'm going to give you some things of how we can maybe apply this. But it's good for us to look this way. I actually show that video to my high school seniors, because I said, look, this is what the culture tells you, but this is what we believe, teach, and confess here at Grace. And I actually used both of these boards, and I went through, and this is, if you follow our formula in Concord, it says, we believe, teach, and confess this. And then it'll say, we deny that. So this is what we're for. This is what we're for against, because we're for this, right? And so on these issues, I actually did that on both boards. We are for this. We are against this for human flourishing. We believe this is God's design and this is not. And there's a whole series from What Would You Say on these issues that help them think. And they're pretty quiet and they're pretty good about it. If you want an encouraging thing about young people are, because they're so digitized, and because they're so infantile in their social awareness of sometimes when it comes to relationships, they're actually not making these sort of mistakes as much as they were when I was a kid. Like, all the data says that, like, premarital behavior, pregnancy outside of marriage, all those numbers are far lower than they were in, say, the 80s and 90s. They've actually dropped. So if you want to encourage, now, the reason they've dropped is not necessarily positive. And the reason is because they don't have real relationships. They're just, you know, doing this thing. You know, you see them they're on a date and they're just talking, you know, it's weird. But when you're all digitized and you're all playing video games, I mean, you don't have time for those things, or you don't form those real relationships. And not even just talking about romantic relationships, just friendships even. It's weird. Now, at our school, I will say again, positive, small school, there's some real relationships and real friendships, some deep friendships that occur here, because you take a lot of classes together and it's kind of like an extended family. Last year's graduating class had like 15 boys, and they had grown, almost all of them had grown up together. And so it was like family, and they acted like family. So they got mad at each other and fought each other, and then they were like best friends. So it was one of those moments. So you can imagine trying to manage them in a classroom when they were getting ready to graduate, how that was last year. But my point is that relational piece is huge. We are, as Aristotle is famous in his politics, said that man is a political animal. And what he meant by that is we're quote unquote pack animals. We're social animals. And so if we're social animals, if Aristotle's right, then that means what happens even in so-called private will impact everything from families to the state, right? And you'll see this happen in this passage in 2 Samuel. And if you notice, I loaded Romans 13. There's a reason for that. But let's look at the Bible Gateway passage. And this is, again, it's lurid. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on it because it's just kind of icky, for lack of a better word. But it's in the scriptures because the Bible is honest about our broken condition. It also adds credibility to the Bible. And you should never forget that. But the Bible does not shy away from David's failings. in this case, his family and his parenting failings. And that should show you that the Bible's honest about our condition and why we need Christ. So here's how this starts. It says, now Absalom, David's son, had a beautiful sister whose name was Tamar. And after a time, Amnon, David's son, loved her. And Amnon was so tormented that he made himself ill because of his sister Tamar, for she was a virgin, and it seemed impossible to Amnon to do anything to her. Well, so first, there's a couple things that are wrong with this. Number one, they're half, if you read through the lines here and you read moms and genealogies, they're half siblings. So this is already illegal, which is one of the reasons he's frustrated. Second of all, the word love here is being used very loosely. Another word we could probably use in our culture is he's obsessed. He's lusting. This is not real self-sacrificial love in this case. This is an obsession sort of thing. And you're going to see after as this goes, how he really is just using her as an object as far as things go. Okay. But Amnon had a friend whose name was Jonadab, the son of Shimeah, David's brother. And Jonadab was a very crafty man. And he said to him, "Oh, son of the king, why are you so haggard morning after morning? Will you not tell me?" Amnon said to him, "I love Tamar, my brother Absalom's sister." That's how you know it's a half-sister. Jonadab said to him, "Lie down on your bed and pretend to be ill. And when your father comes to see you, say to him, 'Let my sister Tamar come and give me bread to eat and prepare the food in my sight, that I may see it and eat from her hand.'" So Amnon lay down and pretended to be ill. And when the king came to see him, Amnon said to the king, "Please let my sister Tamar come and make a couple of cakes in my sight, that I may eat from her hand."
Is that normal?
Yeah. So there's a couple of things. Yeah. And so if you have your outline, so some of you, if you walked in at the end, I gave you this outline. And so what's happening here is the women, especially the women that were not married. So you just call the virgin women, the maiden women, the ladies in waiting that were in the king, they kind of were in their own household. Like they were probably, so how the ancient Near East worked is those, they were protected because they were considered valuable and also under threat if they were, you know, just out in the city or something like that, right? So they were protected. And so it wasn't like even family members had regular access to these women. Okay, they kind of had their own place. They had their own like chamberlain, usually a female, but they also had probably had a male as well who kind of ruled over them. In some cultures, like in Persia, it may have even been a eunuch that ruled over this kind of area and managed the household. David has multiple wives. Again, that's a failure. It's also brokenness on his part. But all the girls of marriageable age would have been kind of living under a certain household, if that makes sense. Okay, so for Absalom to make this request is partially not completely unfounded because maybe he just likes his sister, right? Maybe he says his sister is like one of his friends, or maybe he hasn't seen his sister in a while and he thinks it's going to help make him feel better, or who knows. So for David to agree to this, it's not completely out of nowhere for this request. And the women at this time, this is a very segmented society. And so this is something that women did, is they took care of the men when they were sick, especially in the royal household. So again, none of this is completely weird. It is a little out there. And again, this is where we only know what we know. We don't know if there's, you know, any other previous discussions or previous relationships. We don't know how often the half siblings hung out together, you know, like on family feasts. We just don't have that information. And so it's interesting to speculate. All we know is just kind of the ancient Near Eastern context, if that helps you. But yeah, there's really, did this stand out to David? Did David think this was weird? Did David just go along with it? Oh, okay. Or is David just disconnected? We really don't have much beyond. We do know that he is struggling to manage his giant household. We do know that he does fail several times as a parent and as a father, and we're going to come back to that. But other than that, we just don't quite have it. Go ahead, Luther.
One quick question, the Psalms, does this ever come up in the Psalms? And I haven't read all the Psalms.
The stuff after does.
Just the drama that, because a lot of it seems very personal to David.
Yeah.
But this is, I mean, it's also personal, but it's a different type of drama.
Right. When he flees from Absalom, the answer is yes. So once Absalom gets under the scene here, which he'll show up here at the end of this chapter, the answer is yes. So if not this immediate event, the subsequent events, the answer is yes. So there are Psalms, and when we get to the later chapters, we'll look at a couple of them that David writes involving Absalom when we get to that. So the answer is yes, in terms of the chain of events, there is some stuff in the Psalms that comes out of this. Okay. So anyways, there's a ruse. There's a ruse that's going to go on. He's faking people out. So it starts next, picking up in verse 7. Then David sent home to Tamar saying, "Go to your brother Amnon's house and prepare food to him." So Tamar went to her brother Amnon's house where he was lying down. And she took dough and kneaded it and made cakes in his sight and baked the cakes. We're not sure what these cakes are. Some translations say it might've been like a dumpling. So like, this is like a chicken soup and dumplings. Okay. So it's, that's what this is. Okay. And she took the pan and emptied it out before him, but he refused to eat. And Amnon said, send out everyone from me. So everyone went out from him. Then Amnon said to Tamar, bring the food into the chamber that I may eat from your hand. And Tamar took the cakes she had made and brought them into the chamber to Amnon, her brother, again, half brother. But when she brought them near him to eat, he took a hold of her and said to her, come lie with me, my sister. She answered him, no, my brother, do not violate me, for such a thing is not done in Israel. Do not do this outrageous thing. As for me, where could I carry my shame? As for you, you would be as the one of the outrageous fools in Israel. Now, therefore, please speak to the king, for he will not withhold me from you. But he would not listen to her, and being stronger than she, he violated her and lay with her. Then Amnon hated her with very great hatred, so that the hatred with which he hated her was greater than the love with which he had loved her. Again, she is not a person to him. She's not a person to him. He says, go up, go. But she said to him, no, my brother, for this is wrong, and sending me away is greater than the other that you did to me. But he would not listen to her. He called the young men who had served him and said, put this woman out of my presence and bolt the door after her. She's not even named anymore. I mean, she's so valueless in his eyes. Once he's satiated his desire and then realizes that he doesn't really love her and he doesn't like how she's making him feel guilty, he's callous. He's basically hardened his heart. And so she's just basically an object. Get this woman out of here. That's his response. Okay. So again, sometimes sin begets sin, right? And that's one of the themes through this, going all the way back to David, is that sin begets sin, right? There's a chain of events. Until there's forgiveness and justice and restoration, it can become a horse show, as Pastor Dinger would say. All right. So now she was wearing a long robe with sleeves, for thus were the virgin daughters of the king dressed. Remember, they all kind of lived in the same place. So they all dressed the same too, to identify them part of the king's household. Okay. So his servant put her out and bolted the door after her. And Tamar put ashes on her head and tore the long robe that she wore. And she laid her hand on her head and went away, crying aloud as she went. And her brother Absalom said to her, has Amnon your brother been with you? Now hold your peace, my sister. He is your brother. Do not take this to heart. So Tamar lived a desolate woman in her brother Absalom's house. When King David heard of all these things, he was very angry. But Absalom spoke to Amnon neither good nor bad, for Absalom hated Amnon, because he had violated his sister Tamar. Okay, so that's the first crime. And remember, the chapter before, we have David violating three or four commandments. Okay, with Bathsheba, right? We have adultery and coveting because it's another man's wife. We have murder. He gets Uriah the Hittite killed. He violates the first commandment because he's putting his own desires over God's design. So it's idolatry. So we have David, and then Nathan, the prophet, comes to him and says, because of these sins that have compiled on themselves, your house is going to be in trouble here. Nathan prophesies this, and this is the way this is going to unfold. So we have a couple of crimes. So what, you know, if you want to go to the Ten Commandments, what are some of the commandments that Amnon has violated here, right? Number one, he's coveting, right? So we already got that covenant. It's a form of sexual sin, which adultery kind of covers all sexual sin, right? If you go into the Old Testament. So he's violating that. He's, of course, committing adultery, right? Adultery is when something is taking the place of God in your life. I would say his lusting and his desire after Tamar was a form of idolatry. He's violating commandments, okay? So he violates these commandments, and then there's more commandments that are going to be violated. Again, sin begetting sin is one of the themes here as we see this. If you look in here, some context for you on this outline I gave you. So there, on 6 through 8, the word for cakes, I just mentioned that. It says it may have been sort of a food for the sick. It may be in type of dumpling. So that's why I said it's like chicken soup and dumplings. That's kind of how I'm translating that for you, just in a modern 2023 Idaho, right? But it says such a thing is not done in Israel. So again, between brother and sister, even half brother and sister was forbidden in Leviticus 18. Leviticus 18 and Leviticus 22 is part of the law code of Israel. And all those boundaries are established. And so there's a whole series of those. If you read through Leviticus 18, there's a whole variety of sins on this topic that are said to be verboten, or they're forbidden, or they're sinful, or they're an abomination, or they're unclean to God. So if you look at Leviticus 18, there's a whole list of these. This one's included in Leviticus 18. So if you want to look that up, if we have time today, I can show you that list later. Okay. And so anyways, on 12 to 13 in your outline, it says it stresses the outrageousness, means to seem likely that this prohibition was accepted at the time of David. He will not withhold me from you. Perhaps Tamar is saying that David would be willing to bend the rules, or maybe she's just trying to escape, right? We're not sure because this is like, it starts off kind of macro and then it's like line by line. And so you can see here kind of like saying, hey, don't do this for all these reasons. There's a shame element here. You're being a moron, basically, right? That's basically what she says to him, right? She says, you're a fool, right? You're outrageous. Look what she says. You would be one of the outrageous fools in Israel. Think of your own reputation. Because this, remember what he said in that video? Just because it might be in this private bedroom here, this is going to have real world in the nation, right? You're in the king's household here, okay? Okay, so you're going to be an outrageous fool. I'm going to be shamed. I'm going to be carrying this scar for the rest of my life. You're going to be carrying the shame for the rest of your life. This is a violation of God's law. Oh, just let's talk to the king. Let's talk to David. Let's talk to our dad. See what she's doing here? So it's like compiling on. She's trying to get out. I mean, she's doing everything that she can. And she's in a position where he's going to use his superior strength and his authority. And his he's one of the heirs to the king. And so he has guards, right? And people that serve him and just obey his every whim. And so he's using his authority over her in this way. Okay. All right. And then 16. So after this takes place, she then says this wrong is greater than the other. So if you see the law again, Deuteronomy now 22, but also Exodus 22, if a man seduced an unmarried or unbetrothed woman, he had to marry her unless her father refused. If he had violated or raped her, he was not permitted to divorce her. Having ruined her life, he had a responsibility towards her. So this is an even greater sin because in this culture, remember, women did not have it easy in this culture. And so this was actually a form of protection from God. If you've ever read the book, this is a great one. Pastor Dinger sometimes hands copies of it. Is God a Moral Monster? By Paul Copan. He talks about these laws that protect women because the idea was if you were not married and then you were violated like this, or if you had a kid out of wedlock or anything else, you were basically destitute. Okay, that gives you some context for the Ruth and Naomi story also a little bit because they're widows and they're basically gleaning. They're so poor. They're gleaning stuff out of the fields, right? And so the status of women at this time, I mean, the Bible does more to elevate the status of women than any other surrounding cultures. You should know that, okay? When you compare Israel to, say, Babylon and Egypt and the Hittites and, you know, all these other cultures, the Arameans, when you look at Israel, Israel looks really, really good and really humane compared to the surrounding cultures, just so you know. But these laws were to protect the women. If something like this happened, this was not a she's forced into some relationship she doesn't want. This is she needs to be protected and provided for, or she'll die in the streets. Or she'll die childless, which was also another form of shame in this culture, right? And so this is a way of protecting women. So that's just so you know, this is not a anti-women. It's actually a pro-woman legislation in the culture at the time, okay? So this is a worse thing because not only is it this event, now he's basically condemning her to a life of shame. So that's why he's compounding this sin and why she says this, right? Look what she said, right? She says that following, right? Where is it at? No, my brother, it's verse 16. This wrong in sending me away is even greater than the other wrong you did to me. Which sounds weird to us. But he's not protecting her, or and he's not fulfilling the law, right? He's not, and that's what she's letting him know. Now you're violating another law, which is even worse in a sense for me in terms of the rest of my life. This other one is awful, but we can kind of like try to write some of this, right? You get kind of what she's saying, but now this is even worse because now you're just treating me like chattel, like an animal almost. See ya. Okay, so this is bad. This is awful. Okay. And so now we get to the follow-up with Absalom, her brother. He stews on this. This is an honor culture. So this is murder. It's a form of honor killing. It's an honor killing. He's trying to protect his sister's arm. This is a revenge thing. And so that's what's going to lead us to Absalom. But remember, here's the thing. David does nothing. He gets angry, but then nothing happens. That's important. We're not sure why, but we'll talk more about that as we go. Starting in verse 23. After 2 full years, Absalom, talk about stewing on a grudge, 2 full years, okay? Absalom had sheep shearers at Baal Hazor, which is near Ephraim, and Absalom invited all the king's sons. And Absalom came to the king and said, behold, your servant has sheep shearers. Please let the king and his servants go with your servant. But the king said to Absalom, no, my son, let us not all go, lest we be burdensome to you. He pressed him, but he would not go, but gave him his blessing. Then Absalom said, if not, please let my brother Amnon go with us. And the king said to him, why should he go with you? But Absalom pressed him until he had Amnon and all the king's sons go with him. Then Absalom commanded his servants, mark when Amnon's heart is merry with wine. And when I say to you, strike Amnon, then kill him. Do not fear. Have I not commanded you? Be courageous and be violent. So this violent. Well, that too. Valiant. So faux pas there, but I was kind of a slip there. Okay. But the servants of Absalom did to Amnon as Absalom had commanded. Then all the king's sons arose and each mounted his mule and fled. While they were on the way, news came to David. Absalom has struck down all the king's sons and not one of them is left. Then the king arose and tore his garments and lay on the earth. And all his servants who were standing by tore their garments. But Jonadab, the same guy who gave the bad advice, okay, Jonadab, the son of Shimeah, David's brother, said, "Let not my lord suppose that they have killed all the young men, the king's sons, for Amnon alone is dead. For by the command of Absalom, this has been determined from the day he violated his sister Tamar. Now, therefore, let not the Lord my king so take it to heart as to suppose that all the king's sons are dead, for Amnon alone is dead." But Absalom fled, and the young man who kept watch lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, many people were coming from the road behind him by the side of the mountain. And Jonadab said to the king, "Behold, this king's sons have come, as your servant said, so it has come about." As soon as he had finished speaking, behold, the king's sons came and lifted up their voice and wept. And the king also and all his servants wept very bitterly. But Absalom fled and went to Talmai, the son of Ammihud, the king of Geshur. And David mourned for his son day after day. So Absalom fled and went to Geshur and was there 3 years. And the spirit of the king longed to go out to Absalom because he was comforted about Amnon since he was dead. Okay, so to help make some sense of this, Absalom's mom is the daughter of the king of Geshur. It's like a satellite kingdom of David. David rules over them, basically. He's like an overlord. I think kind of a feudal relationship. And so basically, Absalom runs to grandpa. Okay, so Absalom goes to grandpa and hangs out there to let David cool off and to see what happens with like letting time and inertia, right, be his allies. And so here comes David. But again, David never, notice here, David doesn't go, "We need to go arrest Absalom for this crime." And notice here with Amnon, Amnon's been living for 2 years and has not been punished for this crime. So you see, David, not only as father, but as king, is failing here. Okay, this is not good. Okay, he's not running his household. He's not executing justice as one who wields the sword. God's told him as the king to be the man who rules over the nation, and he can't even manage his own household.
So, Aaron, it was very clear like what happened.
Oh yeah,
I mean, like the entire palace knew that.
Yeah, everybody knows. I mean, if you go back, look what it says right here. Right when David heard of all these things, he was very angry. People knew about this, but didn't do anything. So that's, I mean, and then, so then you wonder, and then Absalom stews on this for two, I mean, think about this. If you're stewing on revenge for 2 years, it gets pretty black after a while, right? Bitterness and all those things. I had somebody describe bitterness as harbored hurt. And in an honor shame culture like this, this is a thing. This is a very emotional culture. They wear their emotions on their sleeves, which is why they mourn publicly and they celebrate publicly. It's a very public thing. I mean, watch, even as late as the 20th century, those Jewish communities in Europe, right? Fiddler on the Roof. When there's somebody getting married, the whole village comes out to celebrate the marriage, right? These are very public things. So when Tamar's walking around with ashes on her head and crying all the time, people kind of know because they all live in community with each other. Notice that when Amnon dies, all of David's other sons are crying and wailing because of it. So in other words, everybody knew everybody. Everybody knew each other's business. There's no such thing as quote unquote this, well, it's just a private thing. It's not a private matter. It's a very public thing, especially in this household. Okay. And so they did not live with like little nuclear families. This is a large palace complex and everybody knew everybody. Okay. So this has real world consequences. Okay.
But Amnon does not strike me as, you know, somebody with good character.
Oh no.
That would cause his siblings to feel genuine sorrow over his demise.
Right. I mean, no, he doesn't seem like this great character, and yet they still mourn him, right? And so maybe he cools off for 2 years, or maybe it was just a blip. We don't know. Or maybe something, and we don't know anything about the character of all these sons either. Who knows? Maybe he was their drinking buddy. I mean, we don't have, you know what I'm saying? We don't have like the full details. We only have what we have, right? But you're right. I mean, it's like, what are you mourning? But again, very different culture. It's an honor shame culture. Even if your brother has done something wrong, you always have your brother's back, right? It's just a different, we got to think a little differently in the ancient Near East. Okay. So he flees and then he returns. Look at this. So then we go to chapter 14. Now Joab, the son of Zariah, knew that the king's heart went out to Absalom. So David misses his son, even though his son is the one who's committed murder. But David, you know, he's still his son. And, you know, some of you parents, when you have kids that run rogue, you still love your kid. You don't stop loving your kid, even when they're doing bad things, right? It's the same thing of God, even. Still loves us, even in spite of us, right? So it's not like David's completely wrong here for loving his son. But again, actions have consequences, right? And you're the king, okay? Anyways, it's verse 2. And Joab went sent to Tekoa and brought from there a wise woman and said to her, pretend to be a mourner and put on mourning garments. Do not anoint yourself with oil, but behave like a woman who has been mourning many days for the dead. Go to the king and speak thus to him. So Joab put words in her mouth. Now, Joab is David's like chief general. He's his right-hand man. He's kind of his prime minister of sorts, but he's really kind of the commander in chief under David. So you got David and then his first, like the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff or the Secretary of Defense is Joab. Does that help you in terms of his character, who he is? Very important. If we're thinking of President of the United States, he's vice president, next in line. He's that guy. He's in the inner circle, okay?
Is there any family relation there?
Distant, very distant, very distant. Not close. He's just one of David's mighty men, and he's proven himself to be the general. He's the general, okay? So Joab's going to manipulate the situation because Joab, this is an act of performance art. He basically hires an actor. Okay, he hires an actor, and David's wise enough to figure this out eventually. It's a fascinating story. Here we go. When the woman of Tekoa came to the king, she fell on her face to the ground and paid homage and said, save me, O king. And the king said to her, what is your trouble? She answered, alas, I am a widow. My husband is dead, and your servant had two sons, and they quarreled with one another in the field. There was no one to separate them, and one struck the other and killed him. And now the whole clan is risen against your servant, and they say, give up the man who struck his brother, that we may put him to death for the life of his brother whom he killed. And so they would destroy the heir also. Thus they would quench my coal that is left, and leave to my husband neither name nor remnant on the face of the earth. Remember, childbearing was like the honor thing in this culture. So the scenario she recreates, she's acting like she's in mourning. I've already lost my husband. I've lost my son. And now I'm worried about my other son. And so I'm going to be a destitute widow, number one. And number two, my husband's name is going to be wiped out. He has no legacy in this. That's the scenario she creates. Okay. Then the king, that's David, said to the woman, go to your house and I will give orders concerning you. And the woman of Tekoa said to the king, on me be the guilt, my lord the king, and on my father's house, let the king and his throne be guiltless. The king said, if anyone says anything to you, bring him to me, and he shall never touch you again. Then she said, please let the king invoke the Lord your God, that the avenger of blood kill no more, and my son be not destroyed. He said, as the Lord lives, not one hair of your son shall fall to the ground. Then the woman said, please let your servant speak a word to the Lord my king. He said, speak. And the woman said, why then have you planned such a thing against the people of God? For in giving this decision, the king convicts himself, inasmuch as the king does not bring his banished one home again. We must all die. We are like water spilled on the ground, which cannot be gathered up again. But God will not take away life, as he devises means so that the banished one will not remain an outcast. Now I have come to say this to the Lord the king, because the people have made me afraid. And your servant thought, I will speak to the king. It may be that the king will perform the request of his servant, for the king will hear and deliver his servant from the hand of the man who would destroy me and my son together from the heritage of God. And your servant thought, the word of my lord the king will set me at rest, for my lord the king is like the angel of God to discern good and evil. The Lord your God be with you. This is great. Then the king answered the woman, do not hide anything from me, anything I ask you. And the woman said, let my lord the king speak. The king said, is the hand of Joab with you in all this? It's just funny. He's like, I know who made you do this. I recognize handiwork when I see it. Joab's crafty. He's a general and he's a politician. He knows exactly what he's doing. The woman answered and said, as surely as you live, my lord, the king, one cannot turn to the right hand or the left from anything my lord, the king has said. It was your servant Joab who commanded me. It was he who put all these words in the mouth of your servant. In order to change the course of things, your servant Joab did this. But my Lord has wisdom like the wisdom of the angel of God to know all things that are on the earth. So Joab's having her buttering him up a little bit, appealing to his pride, but also just trying to get him to kind of have an out so he can allow Absalom to come back. So Joab's manipulating this. The king said to Joab, behold now. So he goes, all right, see you, lady. Come here, Joab. I got this. Okay. Behold, now I grant this. Go, bring back the young man Absalom. And Joab fell on his face to the ground and paid homage and blessed the king. Was that real homage or was he saying, please don't be mad. You know what I did. We don't really know, right? Yeah. And Joab said, today your servant knows that I have found favor in your sight, my lord the king, and that the king has granted the request of his servant. So Joab arose and went to Geshur, that's granddad's, Absalom's granddad's, right? And brought Absalom to Jerusalem. And the king said, let him dwell apart in his own house. He is not to come into my presence. So David is trying to kind of make a stand because you have to be welcomed back into the king's presence to say you're in good standing. And so David's kind of saying, okay, he can come back, but he can't be here in the court. So David's sort of weakly saying something, we need to fix something, but it's very weak, okay? But it does matter in a culture where to be admitted into the king's presence mattered. So this doesn't not matter, and you'll see Absalom's reaction. So Absalom lived apart in his own house and did not come into the king's presence. Now in all Israel, there was no one such as to be praised for his handsome appearance as Absalom. From the sole of his foot to the crown of his head, there was no blemish in him. And when he cut the hair of his head, for at the end of every year he used to cut it, when it was heavy on him, he cut it. He weighed the hair of his head, 200 shekels by the king's weight. It's about 5 pounds. It's a lot of hair. And there were born to Absalom 3 sons and 1 daughter whose name was Tamar. She was a beautiful woman. So Absalom, to honor his sister who was defiled, he calls his own daughter Tamar. So Absalom, for all his faults, loved his sister. And even names one of his own kid after his sister. Which is kind of interesting. It's kind of an honor. He's going to honor his sister and try to say, okay, Tamar, I know this has not gone well for you, but your name is going to live on in my daughter. So it's an act of brotherly love. Again, Absalom's got his own problems, okay? But in this act, there's a little bit of brotherly compassion here to his sister, okay? So Absalom lived 2 full years in Jerusalem without coming into the king's presence. Then Absalom sent for Joab, Joab again, he's a very complex character, Joab, to the king, but Joab would not come to him. And he sent a second time, but Joab would not come to him. So Joab is actually honoring the king's request here. Absalom can live here. He can live in luxury. He can live in wealth, but he is not allowed to participate in the government and he's not allowed to be in the court. And Joab, who's the general and kind of the secretary of defense, right? The right-hand man. He's basically saying, okay, he can't be here either. So Joab actually agrees with this decision. So look what Absalom does. Absalom is all about attention. You'll find that out. Absalom likes the attention, right? He likes his hair. He likes it. He's all about the attention, okay? Then he said to his servants, that's Absalom, see, Joab's field is next to mine, and he has barley there. Go and set it on fire. So Absalom's servants set the field on fire. Then Joab arose and went to Absalom at his house and said to him, why have your servants set my field on fire? Talk about an understatement. You know, in America, it's like, what are you doing? You know, there'd probably be some words there you wouldn't want to repeat. Absalom answered Joab, behold, I sent word to you, come here, that I may send you to the king and ask, why have I come from Geshur? It would be better for me to be there still. Now, therefore, let me go into the presence of the king, and if there is guilt in me, let him put me to death. Then Joab went to the king and told him, and he summoned Absalom. So he came to the king and bowed himself on his face to the ground before the king, and the king kissed Absalom. And that's the end of the chapter. Then Absalom's going to rebel, and David's going to have to run away. So Absalom is about Absalom. He's got that. He's got a little bit of himself. But again, he loves his sister. But it's like, when you dishonor your sister, you dishonor me. You know, so he's kind of, if you read this, it was hard for me as I was reading and prepping this to not think of Absalom as a sort of mob boss. As this goes on, right? He has everybody come and it's a very public killing. He's like, hey, he's killed. I'm not killing everybody else, but you cross me. And so that's why you're dead. And then he names his daughter after his sister. Do you see, you know what I'm saying? He's almost like a mafioso. Is Absalom. He's really, really good looking. And he's like, you dissed me. What? I might as well go back home if you're going to diss me. You got to let me be. Do you see what I mean? He's almost like a mafioso type character as things go. Now, how do we apply this? Here's my point. Next 5 minutes before you have to go. What do we do here? So as I'm reading these commentaries, you have to admit, the Bible's interesting. You can't say the Bible's boring, okay, after reading this, okay? But in these commentaries, one of the things, and again, in the Lutheran Study Bible, there's a few things that we need to mention here. Number one, what are we supposed to apply? Number one, as a parent, you know, David's failures as a parent, David is not perfect. And being an inactive parent and being a parent who sometimes refuses to discipline leads to further problems. And on a macro level, as a king, if he fails to execute justice and fails to even have his own children obey the laws of the land, it actually creates chaos. And so in Romans 13, we have this passage from Paul. So this is one of the ways I'm going to apply this. Let every person be subject to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God, and those that exist have been instituted by God. That's David. He was instituted by God to be king. This is true about us, by the way, too. Okay. Therefore, whoever resists the authorities resists what God has appointed, and those who resist will incur judgment. For rulers are not a terror to good conduct, but to bad. Would you have no fear of the one who is in authority? Then do what is good and you will receive his approval. Now, of course, what happens when they violate God's laws? That's when you obey God rather than men. And there might be a point where you actually end up losing your neck because you're obeying God rather than men. But generally speaking, the kingdom of the left, the governing authorities, are to restrain evil and promote the good, true, and beautiful. That's their job. To restrain evil, sometimes even eliminate evil, and promote the good, the true, and the beautiful. That's their job. Including for people that aren't Christians, right? Or people that aren't the people of Israel. That's your job as the king or as the president or as the police officer or as the governor, to restrain, eliminate evil, and to promote the good, the true, and the beautiful. Well, in this commentary, this is pretty interesting. I found this. This is how he says this. This is, again, this is Andrew Steinman. This is in our sin. He says, God has established authorities in the world in order to restrain sin and reward good behavior. When those authorities do not carry out these functions, but instead neglect their duty to inhabit acts that tear apart the fabric of the civil order, they sin by abandoning their responsibility to God and society. In addition, they also risk further public chaos as those who feel aggrieved by the misdeeds of others fill the vacuum left by sovereigns who have been inattentive to their divine vocations. David's incapacity to deal with Amnon was a contributing factor in Absalom's violence against his brother. And so one of the applications from this is we should pray, and the Lutheran Study Bible does this, you should pray for good leadership and good governance. And it's not wrong to pray to do so, to pray for the president, to pray for Congress, to pray for the police, to pray for your governor, because when they don't do their God-given jobs, it leads to further problems. And that's not wrong to do so. So that's one application from this, okay? Another one is, of course, the parenting part of this. Another part of this is God, while giving us eternal forgiveness, does not promise us that we will be immune from the temporal consequences of our actions. That's through some of these things too. And this is a bit of a law point, but there's going to be a gospel point too. So my law point on this is, yeah, God forgives all of our sins. Yes, Christ wipes our slate clean. We are as white as snow, as it says in Isaiah 1. Absolutely. But that does not mean that in this life, before the resurrection and the life of the world to come, that we will not face the consequences of our actions. God does not rescind his promise to David, right? He never rescinds his promise. In spite of all this brokenness and all this corruption, God never rescinds his promise to David. But David sure bears the consequences for this, right? He really, truly does, of all his actions. And so even though God forgives, even though God will always fulfill his promises and God cannot deny himself, and that is an awesome promise, he doesn't say that you will never face a consequence for your actions. And so that's an important thing. I was going to, as a humorous note, forgot to mention this yesterday. This is an Alex story. So he's sitting right here. I forgot to mention this. We talked about this yesterday, so I know I can. So, this. This is a great story. So how old is he, Jen? Four? 4 years old. He knows all this stuff, right? He's been teaching, not all of this stuff, obviously, but he knows about Jesus. He knows about his baptism. He knows about the forgiveness of sins. You know, we're trying to raise him in the faith. And mom, my wife says, you're going to ground him. Or I don't know. It was a punishment of some kind. And he's like, mommy, you don't have to punish me because Jesus has already forgiven me my sins. Yeah. It was pretty funny. And it was clever. He's had a few moments like that where it's like, okay, he's learning, but he's trying to manipulate that, you know, to his own benefit. But hey, something's true. Oh yeah. We do the exact same thing. That's the whole point. That's why I brought this up right now. We do the same thing. Well, Jesus, forgive me. So I can just do what I want. Liberty is not license. And I think that's one of the lessons that you can take from this. Liberty is not license. We have freedom in Christ. But that's freedom from sin. That's freedom from our bondage. It's freedom from, right? So liberty is not the same as license. And unfortunately, I think we kind of lose that here. So there's a lot of application. Again, it's a little tenuous, admittedly, because it's a hard passage to apply. But praying for good governance, praying for parents to live out their vocation, police officers, anybody else, that's you should. And we should long for those things. And if we're in those positions, you know, fear God and honor God and take those jobs seriously. It's not just a job. Right? It's a God-ordained thing. This may seem odd. I said this to a couple of police officers one time in a class. I said, this may seem odd to you, but when you arrest somebody, you're actually acting with God's sword. That's your vocation, right? To execute justice in the land. And so when you arrest somebody for murder or for abuse or for, you know, selling kids drugs or whatever it is that you're doing, you're acting with the authority of God at that moment. That's how serious that job is and why it's so awesome when we have good officers or good governors and good, and why it's so problematic when we don't, right? And so we should always pray for those things. And then finally, if you want the kind of the gospel notice on this, again, and that's my point, and this does this in this commentary, the end of how this ends, he basically says, through this whole mess, David's failures, God's promise still comes true, and God's promise in Christ is still there, and that forgiveness and reconciliation that takes place still happens, even though David dies. So with all this chaos, this gets us to Solomon, right? You have his sons are dying. You have his half-siblings, attacking other half-siblings. You think, what is going to happen here? Is everybody going to die? And then yet we get to Solomon, who ends up being, you know, for a while anyways, turns out pretty well and is in the lineage of Jesus, right? And so God still fulfills his promises. And the same is true for all of us, right? That in spite of our bad behavior, you know, we return to the Lord. This is a great kind of message of Lent a little bit, you know, return to the Lord, our God, for he is gracious and merciful, full of compassion, abounding in steadfast love, right? He will not say no to his own in that sense, but it doesn't mean that you can just do whatever you want, right? So there's that law and then there's that gospel. And we see that in this passage. All right. People have to go over here. I know it's almost, we're at 10 minutes of the service. Maybe you have comments, questions on this. Sorry. It's a hard topic. This is a hard one. So it's a hard one to teach, as you can imagine. So I was like, how do I do this? But yes, go ahead, Dana.
Either fully punish him and hunted him down and killed him, or should have fully forgiven him?
You know, you have, as the king, you still have to, you have a trial. You'd have to have a trial, right? I mean, he's a judge. He acts as a judge. Like if you go to the Old Testament, right? David acts as a judge. And so one of the things that should have happened is there should have been a trial. And then based on Old Testament law, Leviticus, Deuteronomy, you know, depending on what he finds in those sort of things, you execute according to the law. And whether that's the capital punishment, but it's not. See, the thing is it's not a revenge killing in that case, right? It's not vigilante, because what Absalom does is he's a vigilante, right? He takes justice into his own hands and just does what he thinks to be right. It's an act of vengeance, right? So what David's supposed to do is have a hearing. And then apply the law, and he would have priests and he would have other advisors around him, you know what I mean, as he does this, and apply the law in a public way as king, not as dad, but as king.
But he's done that same thing for Amnon.
Correct. For Amnon, for Absalom, and for Tamar.
Yeah.
And he doesn't in any of those cases. And that's
still his own guilt?
Yeah, I think there might, it's hard to psychoanalyze. Is it because he feels like I did sin similar to this, so I can't judge them? You know, a lot of parents, by the way, I get on parents for this all the time. This is speaking to myself. That's a really bad reason not to discipline your kids. Or, you know, like, well, I did it when I was a kid, so therefore I can't tell him no. No, because you know what that leads to, you can tell him no. Do you get what I'm saying? Don't be as dumb as I was. That's a great message from dad to his kids. Don't make the same mistakes I made. Don't have the damage that I, right? But because of guilt and because of inaption, or because you want to keep people happy, or because you want to say, well, you know, they'll figure it out in the end anyways. It's easier in a sense at the moment, but it can lead to even further problems. But yeah, maybe he does. Maybe he feels guilty because of his previous sins. And so he feels like he can't do anything. It could be. But either way, he's still derelict of duty, right? He's not doing what he's supposed to be doing. But no, that's a good comment. Anybody else want to add to that? My kids are my alarm bell. They're here, so you know. Everybody? All right, let's close with the blessing. The Lord bless us and keep us. The Lord make his face shine upon us and be gracious unto us. The Lord lift up his countenance upon us and give us peace. Amen.
If you have any questions or comments, email them to podcast@gracepocatello.org. And make sure to subscribe to our channel to stay up to date on sermons and classes at Grace Lutheran Church in Pocatello, Idaho. This podcast is designed so that you can take grace with you anywhere you go.